Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
Learned about the message the U.S. is sending to the world now that the Dubai ports deal has fallen apart.
In order to win the war on terror, we have got to strengthen our relationships and friendships with moderate Arab countries in the Middle East. UAE is a committed ally in the war on terror.
But this morning, his administration announced it's postponing free trade talks with the United Arab Emirates. The news comes a day after Dubai-owned DP World said it would transfer the leases of the six eastern ports it recently acquired to, quote, a U.S. entity. For weeks, President Bush strenuously backed the deal in the face of enormous bipartisan pressure from Congress. We'll have more on the political fallout later in the program. But first, joining us on the phone from Washington is Edward Alden, Washington Bureau Chief for the Financial Times of London. And Edward, first of all, what has been some of the response worldwide? How is the world responding?
Well, intriguingly, in the Arab world, the reaction is not as vociferous as you might have expected. I think the regimes there, I mean, in the UAE, it's interesting that it hasn't gotten the intensity of press coverage that it's had here. And I think the reason is the political leaders there really do not want to see this spilling over into the close security relationship between the Emirates and the United States. So they have really tried to tamp down any political anger in their own countries as a result of this action.
Well, in fact, we talked yesterday about a new deal, the State Department reportedly opening an Iranian embassy in exile in Dubai. And so, you know, obviously these are fragile relations.
No, indeed. And I think that's, in fact, why, at the end of the day, the company that was intended to acquire the U.S. terminal facilities backed down. If you read the press release yesterday from DP World, it doesn't say we have decided to sell our U.S. port facilities. It said the ruler of Dubai has told us that we must sell our U.S. port facilities. It was a political decision made by the leaders of the UAE.
Well, and that perhaps saves him face, but do you think it's really true? In other words, what do you think happened?
I think what happened is it became very clear to the White House yesterday morning. It had been clear to others for quite some time that this deal was going to be voted down by Congress. And they picked up the phone to the UAE and they said, you've got to pull out of this because we cannot hold back the tide of political opposition in the Congress. There's no way we can sustain this for another 45 days, as had been the original plan. And the decision was made midday yesterday that it was time to pull the plug.
And by the way, I think my memory is that this transfer of management was supposed to happen right around now. Is more known about who this U.S. company, this United States entity might be?
No, we don't know. I mean, I think the decision was made in great haste. I mean, we had an interview with the chairman of Dubai Ports World on Wednesday in which he insisted that they were going to fight this out and they would not sell the U.S. assets, which literally they actually only acquired yesterday, Thursday. That was when the company's takeover of P&O of the U.K., which had been the previous owner, was completed. So this is sudden, this is a political decision, and they are now going to look around for buyers. I think there are potential buyers, but they certainly didn't have a buyer in mind when they made this announcement yesterday.
Well, Edward Alden, American analysts are quoted today as saying that the U.S. needs $3 billion a day in foreign investment to keep the U.S. afloat, and that the Dubai deal sends the message to those investors, go away. Now, you say that, you know, they're tamping down reaction within the country, but what are, you know, are leaders, you know, saying that they're getting that message?
You know, it depends on what happens from here. If it stops here, I think, you know, if you're a Saudi company thinking about buying a U.S. asset, you're going to be pretty careful about doing that. I don't think you would think twice about investing in treasury bonds, which is where those big numbers come from. So I don't think it's going to affect that sort of investment. It may affect investment in hard assets, particularly in anything that's got a strategic dimension like a port or an airport. The danger is, however, that this is only the start. I mean, Congress has talked about toughening up the rules by which the U.S. screens foreign investment on security grounds. That could have a much broader impact in terms of the willingness of companies from all over the world to invest in the United States. So it remains to be seen what will happen on that front.
Well, and as I said, we're going to talk more later in the program about the politics of all of this, and particularly on President Bush and the Republican Party. But you write today that leaders in Dubai, at least one, I think, are now concluding that President Bush no longer has control in Washington. Have I got that right? Because that's an amazing statement.
Well, I think it's very clear from their action. You know, you had a president who had said, this is a good deal, I'm going to stand behind it, I will veto any effort by Congress to override this deal, and yet at the end of the day, the Dubai company has been forced to do exactly what Congress wanted it to do. So there's no question that the conclusion they reached was that President Bush could not deliver on the commitments he had made to them. And that's a worrisome message. I mean, we've got coming before Congress soon this nuclear deal that President Bush penned with the Indian Prime Minister, Manmohan Singh, just last week. I think it's far from clear that he can persuade Congress to agree to that deal. So the diplomatic repercussions of this could be fairly substantial.
Well, just briefly, the president speaking today said Dubai services more of our military ships than any country in the world. They helped us shut down a worldwide proliferation network run by AQ Khan. Maybe an olive branch to Dubai, but just briefly, too little, too late? I mean, where were these statements before?
Well, I mean, they were saying all these things. It's just nobody in Congress was listening. I think... You know, they're going to try to patch things up the best they can. But the military, the Pentagon is very angry over this. A stunning statement by General Abizade yesterday accusing Congress of Arab and Muslim bashing. That's an amazing statement coming out of one of our top military leaders.
Edward Alden, Washington Bureau Chief for the Financial Times of London. Edward, thank you.
Thanks very much.
Battered by heavy rain and high winds, thousands lost power in Arkansas Thursday, and children huddled in the hallways of their school in Indianola, Mississippi, after reports that a tornado had touched down there. But whenever there are storms, a winter storm of the past is usually invoked, remembered as the worst in the history of the Great Plains. This ferocious storm that blasted down across the Dakotas and Nebraska on January 12, 1888, is known as the Children's Blizzard because it claimed the lives of hundreds of children who were quickly lost in the blinding whiteout conditions after leaving their one-room schoolhouses. Writer David Laskin paints an intimate portrait of this pioneer era in his book, The Children's Blizzard, which has just come out in paperback, and he joins us from the studios of KUOW in Seattle. David, we've talked about this part of the country before. When it comes to deadly weather, we think of the Dust Bowl in the 30s. It's an area that was ripe for a storm. The grasses plowed under, for instance, the dirt left without anything to hold it down. But no one saw this one coming.
The upper Midwest, as you said, is prime territory for severe weather and extreme changes and sudden changes. And blizzards were not unknown. I mean, if any of you have read Laura Ingalls Wilder's book, The Long Winter, that's about the winter of 1880 to 81. But she describes these storms coming in one after another and just the suffering that caused. But the hallmark of the storm that I wrote about, the January 12th, 1888 blizzard, was its suddenness. And that was what was so remarkable and so commented on by the pioneers. The fact that the weather turned so quickly, it had been a very balmy morning in a cold winter. So it was really the first warmish morning for many weeks. People went out assuming it was a January thaw, and then the weather turned on a dime.
So much so that it dropped 18 degrees in 3 minutes?
That's correct in some places. And then, you know, the temperature just kept dropping. So it went from, as I said, relatively balmy weather to record-breaking cold in just a few hours. And record-breaking cold, if you're in Minnesota or North Dakota or Nebraska, is pretty darn cold. So it was that element, the suddenness, the fact that the snow did not come down. You know, often you see in a snowstorm, the sky sort of thickens and lowers, and you get a couple of flakes, and then it intensifies, and then it really kind of sets in and starts to blow. This did not happen that way. The snow came in a kind of wall. I mean, really incredible descriptions that I found of this kind of wall of ice dust that just came blasting down out of the northwest and really took them by surprise. I mean, the other element, too, was that it came at the worst possible time for these kids. It came out of the northwest, so it hit Montana in the middle of the night, hit North Dakota early in the morning. So they were basically okay. I mean, there was bad conditions, but people, for the most part, stayed in. But central South Dakota and Nebraska, which were hit hardest and where most of the fatalities occurred, hit there anywhere between, say, 11 in the morning and 2 in the afternoon. School day, kids at recess, kids at lunch, what have you, that's when the storm hit. And so many of the teachers just told the kids, go home. You know, there's this bad storm, run, get home. and so many of them did not make it.
There were so many stories because of this, you know, zero visibility. A woman in Sioux Falls who froze to death with her door key in her hand just a couple steps from her door. A husband and wife who died while, as you write, blindly circling each other in the farmyard. They were just a few feet away from each other. And then there were the Graber brothers. Now, some of them did survive. They left a schoolhouse, right?
There were three families, actually. They were all Swiss-German Mennonites, and their families had all come over together in the Great Migration of 1873. So there were Kaufmann boys, Graber boys, and one Albrecht boy. And there were seven of them in school that morning. And when the storm came, their teacher, who was named James Cotton, he was one of those teachers who thought, well, better get to shelter, better get to the nearest farmhouse. Now, in his case, he did not dismiss school, as some teachers did. He led the boys. He took them out in the took them out into the storm, formed them into a human chain. They held hands, and they set out to try to get to the Graber family farmhouse.
Because we have to explain here, people could not see their hand in front of their face.
That's something that's come up time and again in the pioneer accounts, and I've actually discussed this with meteorologists today, and many of them have said, well, you know, that sounds kind of incredible to me, but then they began to look at the records, and they said, well, yeah, the conditions were ripe for a total whiteout. The other thing to keep in mind is it wasn't just that the snow was blowing horizontal and the air was so thick with it, but also what happens to your face and to your eyes in condition like this. The snow was very, very fine-grained, and I really found a couple of contemporary accounts of how it would web together people's eyelashes. So essentially, your eyes are kind of sealed shut by this ice dust, and that made visibility even worse. So between the whiteout and what it does to your eyes and your face, you can just imagine how hard it is to see. So getting back to these kids, they're outside within seconds of being in this storm. Their faces are full of snow, they're freezing, they're disoriented, they form a human chain, and they set out together for this farmhouse, which is really only a quarter of a mile from the school. And I actually went, toured that region with a relative of these kids and looked. The school is no longer there, but he showed me exactly where it had been, and he showed me where the farmhouse was and where the kids ended up. The distances were not that great, but in conditions like this, it was just impossible. Well, what happened was that human chain broke when one of the little boys let go of his brother's hand to wipe the snow out of his eyes so he could see a little bit better. These were two of the Graber brothers, and the little brother let go, and at that point, the chain broke. Five boys now were on their own, and the two little boys and the teacher were separated, and some of them made it and some of them did not. It was a really heartrending story for me to tell, and then having met some of the descendants and some of the relatives of that family just made it all the more vivid.
David Laskin's book, The Children's Blizzard, is now out in paperback. It is heartbreaking. It tells the story of a deadly snowstorm that hit the upper Midwest without warning in January 1888. As our winter winds down, it's a reminder of just how devastating weather can be. Well, after a break, you know, we'll hear from David how he conducted that research, how that storm that happened more than 100 years ago is still very much alive in many of the families in the region. We'll have that. And this reminder later in the program, the politics of that Dubai port deal, who is in charge in Washington? Much more coming up here and now. Children's Blizzard is out in paperback. It tells the story of the deadly snowstorm that killed hundreds of people, most of them children, in the winter of 1888. A storm so sudden that many people were quickly lost in blinding conditions. There are stories of survival in the book, people who found a clothesline or a line of trees, something familiar they could touch and, you know, find their way home. Most people, though, did not survive. Among them, five brothers in the Dakotas, the Schweitzer boys. Now, David, your description of how they froze to death on the bleak prairie is heartbreaking. But as you write, a few days after the blizzard, the New York Times reported that many of the victims were found with torn or missing clothing, almost as if they were too warm.
Very often toward the end, when you're in deep hypothermia, people, for reasons doctors still cannot explain, often experience a kind of burning sensation on their upper chest and throat. They feel like their skin is on fire, and they begin to tear off their jackets, take off their shirts, rip open their clothing just when they need it most. And this is a condition that doctors have labeled paradoxical undressing. And they don't know exactly why it happens, but it's well established. And very often, hypothermia victims will be found with their clothes torn open. And, you know, in this day and age, people will think, well, you know, victims of sexual assault. But that's often not the case. It's often that people, when they're freezing to death, when they're very close to slipping into unconsciousness, will start to tear off their clothes. And in fact, that was the case for several of the people that I wrote about, and they were found with their clothing torn open or their clothing removed. Very, very strange. But that's one of the signs that you're very far gone.
I don't know how you did this. I don't know how you immersed yourself in these stories, because they do break your heart.
Well, you know, I think in some ways the part that made it most rewarding for me was meeting so many of the descendants and relatives of the people I wrote about. These were not just kind of dusty historic figures that I turned up in some archive and tried to recreate as best I could. But these were, you know, in some cases, I interviewed a woman whose father was in the storm. In the case of these Schweitzer boys, I talked to their nieces. People who have kept these stories alive, whose parents told them about the stories, these are very much part of their family lore. And I think getting involved with these people, and so many of them were just so sweet and so generous and so interested in their history and in keeping their history alive, that really connected me to the story. And yes, I think in some ways it became more heartbreaking as they showed me pictures of their great-grandmothers and what they must have been feeling when their kids were brought in dead and so on. It made it harder, but it made it more important for me to tell it right and to tell it in a way that people could really relate to.
When the sun came up the next day after the storm, I found myself trying to picture these tableaus, you know, of how people, where people were and how they had frozen. Do you remember some of them? Do they come to mind?
Well, I think the one that comes most to mind is the story we've been talking about of the Schweitzer boys, these five Mennonite boys. And I actually saw the edge of the field where they died, and there were several different descriptions of how they were, what positions they were in when they were found. But one that I think is probably the most accurate is one of them had his arm kind of stuck up in the air. You know, they were frozen solid by the time they were found, but there was a little piece of cloth that he was gripping onto. Another one that just really got me, there were two sisters, the Westphalen girls. They were German girls, and little girls, and they were very close to each other, sisters who had left school together. And they were found huddled up together, and the older girl had taken her cloak off and kind of wrapped her little sister around it. And there were some poems that were written about them at the time. So, you know, she was trying to keep her sister alive. Another of a boy, and I actually met one of his descendants too, who went out and got lost in the storm with his little dog. And he wasn't found until spring, and his coat was found nearby, and he was found. And they can't quite understand why he took his coat off, but they think that maybe what happened was that he was trying to sort of cradle his little dog in his coat, and it somehow got blown away by the wind. I have to tell you, I did spend a lot of time, A, researching the details, and then B, trying to imagine, as you said, exactly what they looked like. It was really helpful for me to meet with the families, to go and walk the terrain that these kids walked. And just, now I didn't do it in blizzard conditions, mind you, thank goodness, but I did go there in winter and walk these paths and walk the farm fields and just try to get a sense of exactly what they were going through and what they experienced when the storm hit.
David, what do we take from this story?
First of all, respect for weather. And I think the other thing is that I really take away from this book is just how hard it was in the pioneer period, and in some ways how strange it was. You know, this was 1888. You know, the cities and the urban parts of the country were actually entering into the modern age. I mean, that, you know, they had electric lights. They had telephones. New York was a sort of big, bustling metropolis, ditto Chicago, same with San Francisco. A lot of money, a lot of glitter. You know, this was the Gilded Age. And meanwhile, out on the prairie, and people were burning hay to keep warm and living, you know, almost in Stone Age-like conditions. So it was the juxtaposition of that. You know, this is a country that has had several pioneer periods, and I think each one has been hard. In some ways, I think this was one of the harder ones, A, because the upper Midwest is a very harsh and unforgiving environment, and B, because it came so late. I mean, these people were, for the most part, immigrants. They had passed through cities in Europe. They passed through New York. They saw what the modern age was capable of, and yet they lived lives of terrible struggle.
That's David Laskins. His book is The Children's Blizzard, the story of the freak storm that caught the Great Plains by surprise in January 1888. Well, there is terrible weather again today. A reminder, powerful storms sweeping several southern states. Now, some people in Tennessee got a close call when there was a fire in a Presbyterian church that was hit by lightning. A tornado twirled about 8 miles across eastern Arkansas yesterday, injuring 4 people. An assistant principal at a Mississippi elementary school where a tornado was reported says children huddled in hallways as the storm passed. Windows were blown out. About 7,600 Arkansas customers lost electricity. You're listening to Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from WBUR Boston, where the program appears to be brewing for President Bush and Republicans in Congress. An AP Ipsos poll shows the president's approval rating at an all-time low at 37%. The same poll shows that by a 47 to 36% margin, Americans surveyed want Democrats to control Congress again. And if the president's advisors had time to look at the Washington Post today, they'd read that one Republican pollster, Tony Fabrizio, thinks the president has no political capital left and that he got rolled by a runaway Congress over the now-dead deal that the administration backed for an Arab company to take over operations in some major U.S. ports. Well, joining us on the line from Washington is John Harwood, national political editor for The Wall Street Journal. And, John, you know, the drums have been beating this way for a while. Does it seem more serious?
Well, it does. Look, this president has had as rough a beginning to 2006 as he had an end to 2005. Democrats couldn't have scripted it any better. To have an emotional issue that really galvanized public opinion against the White House on the core issue of security that sustained this president. So it's a very difficult situation. The best that Republicans can take hope in is that it's over now, at least for the time being, and that many Republicans on the ballot this fall distanced themselves from the White House, and they hope protected them from fallout in November.
But how damaging is it for the whole party that reports are coming out of the conversations that were had yesterday between GOP leaders and the president, GOP leaders saying, we're going to nix that Dubai ports deal, the president saying, I will veto you, and GOP leaders saying in return, and we'll override your veto?
Well, it depends on who's asking the question. If you're at the White House, you say, the president you work for has just taken a blow to his prestige and has had demonstrated for the country and the world that he can't get as much done domestically as he might have thought. On the other hand, if you're the Republican Party and your institutional interest is in holding the House and the Senate against a very strong Democratic effort this year, this was a useful thing for Republicans to stand up, say we're independent, we're not a rubber stamp Congress, that's what Democrats have been saying for the last few weeks, and that we're going to do what we think's right, not just what the White House wants.
Right. Former Bush economic advisor Lawrence Lindsay writes in your newspaper today that the administration could have explained its reasoning on the ports deal and on other issues more artfully. Do you see this as well as a big problem in the Bush administration?
Well, there's no question this was bungled by the White House. They didn't lay the groundwork in public opinion. They assumed, and perhaps this is what happened when you're in the sixth year of your presidency and you've gotten a lot of what you wanted, they assumed that once the president came out on a security issue and said, this is not a problem, trust me, that was going to be good enough, and it plainly wasn't. Once the talk shows got a hold of this, and once you had headlines that linked a critical element of our infrastructure, the ports, with control by an Arab government-owned company. That was just a toxic mix, and Democrats knew they had something powerful, and Republicans did too. That's why they turned their back on the White House and ran away.
And yet, I'm wondering, John, if you think there's going to be even further backlash, because, for instance, we're reading a piece in the Financial Times today about a state-of-the-art device in Dubai for screening containers. Again, perhaps the fault of the Bush administration that they didn't let people know how advanced Dubai's security technology was. But might this, you know, be a backlash against Democrats and others who are just jumping up to condemn the deal because it's an Arab country when more information comes out about how capable Dubai was?
Well, that won't be a problem in American public opinion. Sentiment was just too strong and too locked down on the side that the Democrats are promoting. Now, one question is whether the international community begins to resent more than they already do the United States for being arrogant and making a judgment on this company. You also have the fact that we've had highlighted how little of the cargo entering the United States actually is inspected, and that becomes a new item on the congressional agenda.
Right. Another thing that happened today is the White House announced that the free trade talks with the United Arab Emirates were going to be postponed. They are claiming that it had nothing to do with the Dubai ports deal. But it reminds us, John, we were also hoping to speak to Vin Weber today. He's a Republican consultant. He's also a lobbyist. And it also turns out that he is the consultant for the United Arab Emirates in the free trade deal. And so he's not available. He's kind of busy today. And it just reminds us, you know, when you start teasing this story apart, Americans start to see how enmeshed, really, the U.S. already is with Dubai and the United Arab Emirates.
Well, it takes an episode like this to drive home the fact that, yes, we are in a global economy, and that means companies from all over the world are going to be involved with us and us with them. Look, the second bidder behind Dubai Ports World was a company in Singapore. If the Singapore company had won, we'd still have a foreign company running our ports, but it probably wouldn't have created near the stir that it does. I think at the end of the day, we're going to go ahead with the trade deal with the United Arab Emirates. It's not very credible to say it doesn't have anything to do with this ports dispute. Pretty hard for UAE to sit down with us after the whole world thinks they've been slapped in the face by the United States. But look, we're involved economically all over the place with China and many other countries that we in other realms regard as adversaries, and that's not going to change.
I want to look ahead to next week, John, before we let you go. The president's budget comes up for votes in Congress. Senate Democrat Robert Byrd pushed Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld yesterday about war spending and the numbers. But so did GOP budget chief from New Hampshire, Judd Gregg. He's had questions as well. Again, is this more of this sort of Republican revolt we're seeing?
Well, it is partly Republican revolt and partly the fact that we just see an increasingly pessimistic attitude from American politicians and the American public about where Iraq is going. People think that we have got an incipient civil war there. They already were wanting to get U.S. troops out. Now that desire is going to be accelerated. It's going to be very interesting to see whether the Bush administration can sustain support for an orderly drawdown of troops. Everybody assumes that troops are going to come down this year. The numbers, we're at about 135,000 now, and people think that number is going to be smaller. But how can they prevent basically a snap decision by the Congress to really accelerate that process? That's a big political challenge for the president during this election year.
Well, and speaking of which, we want you to get out your crystal ball for just a second. In your Washington Wire column today, you point out a joke about those presidential poll numbers that we mentioned. Andy Borowitz, one of our favorites, said that the avian flu is now more popular in polls than President Bush is, but the avian flu is still one of the issues ahead of us, you know, on the agenda. Where do you think President Bush goes from here?
Look, these numbers in the high 30s, that's a precarious position for a president to be in. His father got lower at certain points, so did Jimmy Carter and some others, but he doesn't have much political capital remaining, and he's got to find some issues that he can use to unite his party and recover a bit of his credibility and his reputation for getting things done. Immigration might be one of those issues.
John Harwood, national political editor for The Wall Street Journal. John, thanks.
My pleasure.
And this news from Washington just in, the Associated Press is reporting that Interior Secretary Gail Norton is announcing her resignation. We'll have more on that news if it's warranted. Stay with us. Much more ahead here and now.
A former member of fugitive Whitey Bulger's Boston crime gang said he once trained a rifle on one of Bulger's biggest critics, but when he saw that the local newspaper columnist had his daughter by the hand, he decided not to pull the trigger. Gangster-turned-author Kevin Weeks tells this story on 60 Minutes this Sunday, and it's launched a new series of columns from always colorful Boston Herald columnist Howie Carr. Howie joins us now, and Howie, your response. Kevin Weeks said he was going to assassinate you.
I'll tell you, Robin, what I told Ed Bradley. I don't think Kevin had the stones to do it.
All right. As we said, the always colorful. You go on to say that Kevin was just a boy who played Robin to Whitey's Batman. This is in your column today, that he promoted himself from gravedigger to hitman. He described your house, Howie, and he said he was in the cemetery across the street.
You know, Robin, it's not like he had to do a lot of legwork to find out where I lived. A close personal relative, I won't throw his close personal relative under the bus the way Kevin did, lived around the corner from me. And what I assume is that they were just driving around one day, and the guy just pointed out and said, that's where Howie lives. And he's been telling this story, Robin, for 10 years.
Why would he do this? I mean, why would he say that he was told to kill you?
Because I think it provides good publicity for his book. And by the way, I have a book out, too, that's on the New York Times bestseller list. It's called The Brothers Bulger. So this is actually good for me, and I appreciate his story here, but I just don't put a lot of credence in it.
Well, he also says that Whitey Bulger wanted to blow you up with plastic explosives hidden in a basketball.
You know, Robin, again, they threatened to kill me. Whitey Bulger was a serial killer. He was a gangster, a cocaine dealer. He's on the FBI's 10 most wanted list. He's been a fugitive for 11 years. There's $1 million federal bounty on him.
We should say he's the second most wanted man on that list behind Osama bin Laden.
Correct. And he is a very dangerous person. They told one of my coworkers that if I ever came in their liquor store, they had a dumpster waiting for me out back and were going to chop me up. Now, when you get that kind of message from Whitey Bulger, you take precautions. However, I don't think that Kevin Weeks is in quite the same league as Whitey Bulger.
Did you take precautions at the time?
Absolutely. I drove home a different way every night. In the old days, when we worked together in TV, you know me, I used to you know, finish my shift and like to spend a few hours at the local bar rooms. And as those days ended, the moment I heard that they were going to chop me up and put me in a dumpster.
And well, and now Kevin Weeks is talking about your daughter. Aren't you worried even now about thumbing your nose at these guys?
I'm really not, Robin. I mean, I've had a lot of time to think about this, and I was concerned up to the day that Whitey disappeared in December 1994, and I always wondered what would happen, and I tried not to hang out after dark in South Boston. I tried not to make a mistake. I never met anyone who wanted to meet me whose name I didn't know. And again, I was never a creature of habits after the threats were uttered against me. But Kevin Weeks is just not in the same league with these guys. He's promoted himself from gravedigger to hitman. He went into court and has testified under oath that he never pulled the trigger on any of the murders.
Well, and we should say Kevin Weeks was arrested in 99. He says he flipped on Whitey Bulger after he found out that Whitey wasn't just using the police and FBI agents as his own sources.
Oh, give me a break.
But that he was giving information about bad guys. This is what Weeks said. Weeks served almost 5 years. But now he's an author. By the way, how do you feel seeing him as an author?
Well, you know, everybody's got to make a buck. Again, like I said, I've got my book out.
Actually, we had a question about that. How is it? We thought you weren't supposed to be able to profit from crime.
You and I are thinking of the Son of Sam law in New York. I don't think there is such a law in Massachusetts. I know he's being sued or has been sued by various victims or the survivors of victims that he buried and that he was convicted of helping to murder. But I don't know how it's going to work. I assume he plans to keep, or he thinks he can keep, most of the money here.
Okay. Howie, if there's a basketball in your driveway, do not kick it.
Hey, Robin, there are two movies, The Replacement Killers and Death Wish 5. They have scenes very similar to the ones Kevin Weeks described.
So you think he's just been going to a lot of movies?
I think so.
Howie Carr, thanks so much.
Thank you, Robin Young.
Howie Carr's book about fugitive Whitey Bulger and his brother, once one of the most powerful politicians in Massachusetts, William Bulger, is called The Brothers Bulger. For more, go to our website, here-now.org. Stay with us. More ahead, Here and Now. But did you know shrimp do, too? Maine's shrimping season runs this year from January to the end of April. The tiny crustaceans caught in Maine's icy waters are sweet, pink, delicious, in demand at expensive restaurants. But some fishermen say it's hardly worth their while to fish for this winter delicacy. Here Now's resident chef Kathy Gunst recently went up the Maine coast to learn more about shrimp. Her guide was Chef Sam Hayward. Her story begins dockside in Georgetown, Maine.
My name is Sam Hayward. I'm the chef at 4th Street in Portland, Maine, and I do a lot of seafood, and I'm pretty interested in local foods whenever I can get them. That's sort of the basis of what we do. And then we're standing on the dock at Five Islands, which is in Georgetown, Maine, in the mid-coast. Ira Pinkham is a fisherman who does lobstering in the summertime, and this time of year he's doing shrimp. His family has been fishing in this area for a long time, and it'll be interesting because he really knows his stuff.
Hi, Ira.
How you doing?
I'm Sam.
How you doing, Sam?
Nice to meet you.
My name's Ira Pinkham, captain of the Miss Morris Island. We're in the mouth of the Sheepskin River.
What is it about Maine shrimp? Everyone's talking about problems selling them. It doesn't have the reputation of Maine lobster.
No. What got us this year was the import of overseas shrimp coming in. They opened up trade with other countries, and it kind of ruined our market.
What is it that's special about Maine shrimp?
Sweet. And there's only here in Canada catch it, that's it. Cold water shrimp. They're just better tasting all the way around. This is how we haul them up right here. No more hand over hand. A lot quicker. Just dump them right in the basket.
Can you open the trap?
Yeah, just give it a little shake like that.
Okay, these are, they'd be familiar as an easily identifiable to almost anybody as a shrimp. I mean, it's certainly, in the basic shape, it looks like any shrimp that you've seen on a shrimp bar in anywhere in the South or New York or any big city. But it's significantly smaller. This one looks like it's about, from the point of the rostrum, which is really quite sharp and needle-like, to the tip of the tail, is probably 4 inches, 3.5 to 4 inches.
We used to get $1 to $1.50 a pound for them. Now we 25, 30 cents. Middleman makes all the money now.
Can you tell us your name and what the name of your business is?
Timmy LaRochelle from Always Fresh LaRochelle Seafood in Auburn.
And you're on the boat here to check out these shrimp, and you're going to buy them and
I'm
bring
gonna
them
I'm going to buy them and take them to a place where we box them, and then they go on a truck in Portland, and they get taken to New York, and they'll be fresh shrimp tomorrow for New York.
So you're the middleman that's making all the money?
Yeah, right. I'm the one making all the bucks.
So you're going to buy them today from him, the fisherman, for 35 cents?
40, yeah.
40 cents. 40
today?
Yeah.
Okay, and then what are you going to sell them for?
I make a nickel trucking. In my market, we're getting 75 cents if you buy 20 pounds or more.
And that's to a chef in New York or a fish store in New York?
This is to a distributor in New York, which will distribute it, I'm sure.
And then that guy is
going
to sell it to the chef in New York for, what would you think? What will it go up to?
He's probably going to pay close to $1 a pound.
And then what do you think he's going to charge on the plate?
In New York, for fresh shrimp like this, you're probably talking 20 bucks a plate.
And there you have the cycle.
Yeah.
We are off the shrimp boat. We are in the warm, lovely kitchen, Sam Hayward's home kitchen in Bodenham, Maine. We have these shrimp. They were squirming. They were alive. We put them in a bowl of icy cold water. Why?
Well, it helps to separate the meats from the shell so that they shell a little bit easier. We're going to get the benefit.
Can I help you?
Please. We're going to get the benefit of the freshness.
So you pull off the head, or what did he call it?
Yep, yeah, or the carapace.
The carapace, and then we
peel off the shell of the tail.
Pinch the tail. So, Sam, what do you have in mind?
Well, I thought we'd try three different things that might reveal something interesting about the shrimp, each one of them. I think we'll want to taste it raw first.
So we're going to try them raw?
Yeah, I'm just going to grab one and eat it.
Okay.
Wow. Mm. Now, these are so incredibly sweet. They're
so fresh.
Almost sugary. And generally, when I work with these,
I like to do things that really interfere with their flavor as little as possible and accentuate that distinctive sweetness that makes them so different from any of the southern shrimps that people tend to be more accustomed to. But then there's this other thing we do that's the next step. It doesn't really take it all the way to a ceviche in which seafood is cooked, as it were, by acidity, by adding something like lime juice or vinegar. We call it shocking. And all we do, it's the simplest thing in the world. To the fresh shelled shrimp meats, I toss in just a very few drops of this very nice sherry vinegar.
Okay, so that's it.
Just a few drops, and I put it on a plate and then sprinkle over the top of it a little bit of kind of crunchy sea salt, which adds not just the salinity, but the texture,
yeah.
And it frames the sweetness in a different way of the shrimp, and it doesn't mask the flavor.
So we've got about a half a pound of peeled shrimp here.
I would
here.
Guess that's about what we've got. I'm just going to add just a few drops of sherry vinegar.
Like a tablespoon.
Yeah. Not even.
Toss them around
very quickly. Let it sit for about 30 seconds.
Now, this is a recipe you could do at home.
Anybody could
do. A 30-second recipe.
I don't even call this a recipe. This is simply another way to
eat. Oh, that sherry vinegar sure smells good on that fish. And you're just going to sprinkle it with some coarse sea salt? Mmm. Wow.
Isn't that a revelation?
It's transformative with two ingredients in 30 seconds.
But that's what I love about cooking with really fresh local ingredients. A couple of elements and a sense of restraint and care for the raw materials. And this is what you end up with. And it's immensely so. You could eat these all day. Now I think I'm going to do something that's a little more contemporary, which is to take
cook
the shrimp.
Them?
We're going to actually cook them this time. Which isn't necessarily always an improvement, some people treat Maine shrimp. So we're going to do it really simply, in a really popular style, which would be to simply coat them with a little flour or cornmeal, and then cook them in really hot fat. We're going to do that in a shallow skillet in about a half an inch of, I'm using grapeseed oil, which is terrific because it can take high heat.
Right.
And now for actually cooking the shrimp, and I'm not going to do anything else to them. I'm not going to add them to milk or egg or anything like that to coat them. We're simply going to take them over to the stove. I think I need to season them first, as opposed to seizing the flour.
So now you're just going to coat them lightly in flour.
Lightly coat them with flour. And then shake them off in a wire strainer to get rid of most of the excess.
Right, so there's just a little bit of flour. So this is a real quick fry. You're not going to let it go for long.
Right.
So I just these babies cook fast.
They do. Can't wait for you to try this.
I think I can't wait.
Please, help yourself.
Okay, thank you. Oh, man. Sam Hayward, thank you so much for this Maine shrimp education and the enlightenment on winter cooking. I look forward to hitting my kitchen, and I think, you know, we learned quite a few things.
Well, thank you, Kathy. It was a real pleasure.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Where's ours? Our piece on Maine shrimp was produced by Kathy Gunst with help from John Rudolph and Vince Fairchild. Here Now is a production of WBUR Boston. Our production team includes Lynn Menegon, Kevin Sullivan, Emiko Tamagawa, Alex Ashlock, Tara Murphy, and Virginia Prescott. Doug Sugars is our engineer. Our web producer is Ken George. Our newscast producer, Steve Brown. Our interns, Daniel Estrin, and until we cut the cake and the umbilical cord later today, Angela Kim of Emerson College. She's going to soon graduate, we hope. Stay in public radio. Angela, thank you for all your help. And write us if you ever discover the ability to have a bad mood. The senior producer of Here and Now is Kathleen McKenna. I'm Robin Young. Join us again, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI. Public Radio International.
I'm Robin Young. Join us next time for the news and these stories here and now.